right, hello and welcome to the At YouTube Podcast, the unofficial official At YouTube Podcast, episode number 49, where we are talking all things YouTube. And in this particular episode, we are doing the Nolith. I don't know how you say that. It always looks funny when I see it written. The No Line on the Horizon, anyways, episode. And I've got with me some lovely co-hosts, some guests, some people from around the world. And first up, Sherry's back. Welcome, Sherry.
Hey, I found grace beside the sound this time, so we're good.
And Aaron.
Hello.
Hello, Aaron and Lisette.
Hi, Chris. I'm not going to buy your cockatoo.
There we go. I need my prize now, sound now for the best. Aaron, it's been a while since Aaron's been on, so he hasn't been up maybe with the sound of people quoting some random lyric from the episode or from the album when they're introduced. So I forgive you, Aaron.
I'll try my best.
He's just got on his bossy boots, Chris. Yeah,
exactly.
Oh, dear.
We'll get to that one in a minute. So
I've got the lyric page out now, so I'm going to cheat.
But yes, Lisette gives the prize for this episode, that's for sure. If you're new to this podcast, welcome here. And we record it live Wednesdays or Thursdays, depending on if there's more European friends on than North American friends. And it's found at goodstuff.fm/ATU2 or, of course, on atu2.com, as your case may be. We've got a few, just some listener comments about the album that we're going to just run over quickly before we get into the discussion of it. At Tim Jahar said, No Line on the Horizon was ignored on the I&E tour. Do you see it coming back around in future shows? I happen to love it still. And that's obviously, what do you guys think? There's the Joshua Tree tour coming up, obviously, and then the presumably, if and when it ever comes out, Songs of Experience and related tour. Do you think No Line will make any songs will make an appearance in either of those tours? Try to be brief, but what do you think?
I think there's a chance or two. It gets more and more difficult, isn't it, as the band create more songs and we all seem to have no particular reason not to want to hear the songs again, despite some of the songs not being as great, but it's more difficult. Their catalogue is getting massive now, isn't it? It's about 200 songs, so how do you do it?
Yeah.
Well, I do think Moment of Surrender would fit nicely in almost any tour, really. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that one. Magnificent, too, you could see throwing in somewhere, too. And sonically, there's a few, you know, songs that could be snippeted or otherwise. But we'll see. Follow-up from Tim Jahar said, will we ever see release of material from the Fez sessions? Which, what made it onto No Line is some of his favorite stuff on there, which maybe we'll cover a little bit when we discuss some of the linear inclusion of the video, music video documentary thing that's included on the deluxe album.
There might be snippets or stolen pieces from those sessions that may make their way into Songs of Ascent. Songs of Ascent was something that started getting batted around the recording sessions for No Line. So we might see some hints coming forth on that future release.
I just never know how seriously to take some of those, that commentary from Bono, especially obviously what he's saying.
Well, but one thing for sure, just going back to the listeners' question, they did very much experiment live on this tour in terms of doing a bit of a road rehearsal on some of the songs that, you know, Avery Breaking Wave, North Star, a few of them have had a bit of a go.
And Glastonbury came from those sessions. Mm-hmm.
That's right. So there's an every chance that some of the songs that they may have started writing in Fez and doodling around, I guess, will eventually come out. As I say, either might be even on Songs of Experience, because North Star, I might come on the next album. And certainly Songs of Ascent. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Jeff in the chat, or UTGW in the chat, says, I believe Songs of Ascent will come out when it comes out. Just must be a software developer. At Shaden TB says, is No Line on the Horizon definitively their worst album, or does that honor permanently reside with Pop in the pantheon of terrible album / phenomenal concerts, No Line and / 360 being the tops? Which is, I'm guessing since the three of you wanted to be on this episode, you don't agree that it's the worst album, but we'll get into that discussion. Might have a few disagreements with at Shaden TB, but we appreciate all perspectives on the YouTube stuff as we go through this. So by way of introduction, we've been doing a album by album series with a few little interruptions and B-sides along the way, from Boy to Songs of Innocence, as of this recording anyways. Started back in episode 34 with Boy, of course, and so we're going into No Line on the Horizon, our second last official album anyways, again, as of right now. I haven't checked iTunes to see if they've dropped a new album yet, but I'm assuming we would have heard about it by now, but... the album was released just by, I'll just do a bit of quick Wikipedia data dump on you in case you're a little fuzzy on the album. It was their 12th album, released in February 2009, produced by Eno Lanois and Steve Lillywhite. They'd begun work on the album back in 2006 with producer Rick Rubin, but apparently it shelved most of the material from that session. When it came out, it debuted at number one in 30 countries, but didn't sell as well as they were hoping. Which saying around 5 million copies, nothing to sneeze at, obviously. But then the tour, the U2 360 tour, that went from 2009 to 2011, was or is the highest grossing concert tour in history, with ticket sales over 736 million.
And I think it got eclipsed by One Direction last year.
Oh, did it?
No. Oh, God.
That's a funny state of the affairs. But
that's actually quite embarrassing. Is that right?
Well, ever since Larry started losing his boy band looks, you know, it's all been downhill from there.
Oh, yeah.
You can Larry love or hate to Sherry. there's one quote I pulled out that I really love from Adam Clayton back when they were recording, saying in early December, so just before it was released, a couple months before, but this is definitely the last week of recording, but then again last week was definitely the last week of recording and the week before that, so the poor bass player who's probably had his lines and his tracks all done for months already and just waiting for Edge and Bono to finish up what they're doing. And on that note, there's actually a great, if you're a music or recording nerd, I came across, and I'm sure it was linked way back when the album came out, but a great album or article discussing how the album and recording process went with U2 over on soundonsound.com, which we'll put in the show notes, where one of the engineers on the project, I don't know if he's still around with U2 or not, but sort of details his journey going from place to place and how they capture all the millions of ideas and remember where to find them 3 weeks after the fact and that kind of stuff. So it's a great read if you're an audio nerd and or U2 fan, of course. So and some of the album artwork is where the Bowden Sea is what somebody threw in the notes as well, which is where,
yes, by the artist Sugimoto. And this is also the first album where Eno and Lanois got songwriting credit on,
right, which goes a little bit to that. You can sort of, we'll get into that discussion, I guess, but of just the overall album sonically, it definitely feels, I remember when it came out, it felt a little sonically like out of the place of U2 compared to where they'd been anyways. And even listening to Songs of Innocence now after it, it definitely has a more experimental vibe to it than the previous and the post albums, I guess, for it. But what were your guys' impressions when it first came out and you first sort of had a listen through? Aaron, we can go start with you. And
well, I think this is probably the one album in U2's catalogue that probably is the most blended of all of the U2 albums. It has a bit of every type of style in all of the songs, more so than probably any other album. And what you just mentioned was right. The albums before, All That You Can't Leave Behind and How to Dismantle, were pretty much more formulaic U2. You know, U2 by numbers, I guess, in some respects, when you compare it with this album. So it does sound quite sonically different. I'm not always sure that it was the sound that U2 wanted to do. And I know there's been some comments by Eno and Lanois and Lillywhite in particular, who I think got in trouble with management at a later date, about what they were trying to do, particularly the Moroccan sound. It didn't quite come through. There's a few snippets of it on perhaps something like Moments of Surrender. But they certainly did do something quite different in 2009. You know, these are the guys now are turning or getting close to being 50 years old. And some of the things they do on the album is really good. And there's one or two tracks which are real duffers, in my opinion. I think we know what song might be the one that's generally regarded as the duffer. But it's a great and brave album by a band that at their stage in their career, in my opinion. And I think sometimes, you know, you don't listen to the album preceding, which is where this album is now, because, you know, you still listen to Songs of Innocence, at least I am, and you tend not to listen to it so much, but I still go back to this one quite a lot. I like dipping in and out of it, and it's quite a nice mood-setting album. I think that's one thing it is for me. But, you know, the guy earlier said, you know, asked his question about what album is the worst album. I don't think there is a worst album. I think it always goes back to which is the one you least go back to all the time, and there's lots of different reasons. But this album, I think, is a nice mood-setting album for various reasons.
Yeah. How about you, Lisette?
Well, yeah, I kind of agree with Aaron. I don't hate any U2 album, really. I like Alone Died on the Horizon. I don't like all of the songs, but most of them, yeah, they're quite good, I think. And I also like the idea of Bono, like, creating characters. It's like something he really didn't really do before, so it didn't work all the time. But I think in some songs it was really nice, like in White as Snow, for example. And, yeah. Well, I like the album. Yeah.
How about you, Sherry?
Well, at the time that this came out, Bono and Edge were both working heavily on Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark at that point. And I think that that character writing blended together between these sessions and what they were doing for the Broadway show. When the album first came out, Matt asked the AT staff to write, you know, 200 words or less, your first impression on the album. And the first thing that I thought of was that the 11 tracks are more like quilt pieces than one knitted blanket, leaving me yearning to have it wrap around myself like the past U2 albums have. And this is an album that has had to grow on me. You know, Adam said in Rolling Stone recently about songs sort of being like a bedroom a song where it's private to you, but it may not be everybody's favorite cup of tea. And I think every song on No Line fits that description for me. It's something that as I've grown older, I've certainly gotten a better appreciation for. You think that when it was being written, the band were in their late 40s. And I'm quickly approaching that part of my life now. And I can see now where they're coming from. But I had to get through some life experiences in order to fully appreciate this album. It's not for your casual U2 fan. This is for somebody who needs a good thinking album. That's where No Line fits in my U2 pantheon.
Yeah, it definitely is in hindsight and now, and probably the further we get away from its release, the more, I guess, credit they should get, like Aaron said and Sherry too, as far as being more experimental than we thought and even appreciated at the time, I think, and coming off of what they had. And maybe they felt a bit of freedom, you know, having the success they had with the previous albums to do that and sort of experiment. The only, my one worry is that because of how it didn't perform well in terms of sales, then they'll be scared off from doing anything similar ever again before their career is done. But we'll see. That's still, we're not talking about the end of U2's career yet. Don't worry. Well, it's still a long ways away, right, everybody? We're not.
Well, you know, the album sales, when you have a tour that is named after the album, you tend to have better album sales. When they started plugging U2 360, they were plugging the 360 degrees of the stage, not, hey, this is the No Line on the Horizon tour. I think that kind of shot themselves in the foot, so to speak, as far as the viability of the album. And in 2009, you know, when they came out, they were playing a lot of songs off that album. In 2010, when the tour had to be put on ice because of Bono's back surgery, when they resumed it in 2011, they reworked it so that there were only, what, maybe three at most No Line songs out. So at that point, I think that the band had basically abandoned this particular album in favor of, dare I say it, doing a greatest hits show for those $753 million that they made on the 360 tour. I think that if Bono's back hadn't done what it did in 2010, it might be a different story, but we can't change time.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into the song by song discussion, and we'll go starting with No Line on the Horizon.
Yes, so No Line on the Horizon. Well, this is, for me, probably one of the lost U2 singles. It should have been a single. There's no two ways about it. You know, I don't want to go too much into Get On Your Boots, but...
Oh,
it's the elephant
there.
In the room, eh?
I'm going to go... A calling card single? I don't think so. Return to Sender. Don't like it. This should have been... there's about three or four different tracks in this album that could have been the first lead single. This one definitely could have been a first lead single. And in fact, you know, you go back to as well, Will I Am had had a bit of a go at remixing this. You know, some extra tracks released as B sides, whatever, on the first single.
Was that also on Artificial Horizon, the fan club release?
That's it. Yeah. And I really do think this is one of the if it isn't the lead single, it should have been a single off the album. I thought in a live context in particular, it was very, very good. I mean, in the early days of the tour, this song actually opened the show. If it wasn't opening the show, it was placed towards the mid set, and I thought it worked very, very well. So it's a great song live, and it's a brilliant song as well. In terms of just the sound engineering and the different sounds Edge gets out of the guitar, I think he was experimental with a lot of different pedals, and the, you know, this was a very Sonic produced Eno style song. So I love that type of European Germanic Kraftwerky type sound. I love all that stuff. So this song in particular really does suit me. And of course, you know, the whole theme of the album starts off like that. There's a lot of character-based lyrics in this particular album, more so probably than any other album that Bono has done the lyrics for. And I thought this was a great image. It's one of these albums where you can certainly just put your headphones on and just float away. And this song, for me, makes me float.
Nice, and it kind of goes to, like, I mean, we can have the single debate, I guess, all the way up until we get the track to Get On The Boots, but with each song probably. But it does, going to what Sherry had said earlier, just about even having a single that's named after the album and that kind of stuff, marketing-wise anyways, it would have made a little bit more of a mental hook for people to grasp where it's going and where it's from and which album this is and which one should I go find in iTunes or in the record store.
Like Sherry said, I think the Bono's back injury really messed up the tour. The length of the tour was obviously very long. I mean, it was just over 2 years, wasn't it, in the end?
Yeah.
Or just around 2 years long. But obviously interrupted a couple of times. And as you say, towards the end, I mean, you know, I went to Glastonbury in 2011. And I think apart from Moment of Surrender, I don't remember any other song off this album. Oh, they did play Get On Your Boots, but I'll try to forget that now.
I love the line, she said, time is irrelevant, it's not linear, which I think was in the clip. And then the next, she put her tongue in my ear. Just the way it's kind of like those two little lines. And then I think of this album almost as like the Bono wailing album, because he does a lot of that sort of wailing in a positive way. It's not the Pride or 40 kind of sad wailing. It's more the I've been out too late tonight kind of joyful wailing.
And I remember being on holiday on the coast when this album came out, and literally looking out the window, looking at the sea, pretty much I think what Bono is referring to, you know, in the lyrics. He looks out of his own window, presumably out of Killiney, and looking across the Irish Sea. And it's just a very peaceful, it's not a peaceful song, but it puts me in a peaceful mood when I hear it. So I like it. I like the way that the sea and the sky and the horizon have a certain image in my mind.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's keep moving on to Magnificence. This foolishness can leave us.
wow, this is a great song. I mean, I don't want to say it, but it is magnificent. It really is. And, you know, such a simple guitar line as well, guitar riff. It's not a riff, is it? It's just a repeat of a couple of notes over and over and over again. But I just love, this is a very typical U2 song in some respects. And I love the video for it. I love the whole imagery. The song is, again, one that really lifts off. This could have been the lead single. I mean, it was a single. I think it was the second single,
if I recall.
Yeah, I
don't think that they would have selected Magnificent as the lead single.
Probably,
based, based on the lyric, I was born to sing for you. You know, Bono even felt kind of odd, you know, being so bold and brash with the declarations within it. So even having it be the second single, he was already apologizing for it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's nice because this particular song has Adam playing some very nice bass. There's a long intro into the song, which probably actually wouldn't have suited radio very well. I mean, it was edited down for the download. And I think this was actually the first U2 single, certainly in Europe, that had no physical release. You couldn't buy it. Mm-hmm. You know, just going back to the album, some of the songs here and the tour, this is actually the first album, almost in the transition period of where everybody bought a CD. Because if you think about it, How to Dismantle Atomic Bomb, it's very early days of, did iTunes even exist? I can't even remember. It probably did. Yeah, of course it did. Mm-hmm. But it certainly was a minority way of buying your music. And then we're moving into 2009 where, you know, iTunes streaming still didn't really exist in any way, shape or form. So the whole audience is shifting into a very different way of how they listen to music, how they listen to albums. And I think the whole tour struggled with different people having different enthusiasm for listening to an album or just listening to the songs that they were familiar with or the album songs they were familiar with. And this is the first time where U2 start to lose their audience a little bit in the live setting, despite the album and the tour being the best, you know, the biggest tour of all time. There was occasions where some of these songs just didn't connect, particularly Magnificent, which is a great song, but even in the live setting, it just didn't quite connect with the audience. I don't know how you felt about that, Sherry, and
well,
the live set.
For the second Foxborough show in 2009, they came out and opened with Magnificent. And I thought that was a far better opener than Breathe. I'm sure that I will have a lot of people disagree with me on that, but it got everybody up and dancing and bopping, and I also thought that it was great to open up a show with a prayer almost, you know, because you were certainly closing with one. I always felt that Magnificent should have been the tour opener.
Well, I really liked Breathe as a tour opener, actually. So, yeah, I don't really agree, but yeah.
Yeah, kind of where I was looking for where I was in one of Adam or somebody's interview with Andy Green and Rolling Stone, where he talked about sort of that mid-tempo malaise song. That it is like an upbeat song, but it's not quite fast enough maybe to be a dance song. I guess you had the experience of it in a full stadium, which is always, you know, when it's live, it's hard to not get into this music, but as a, you know, the whole stadium rocking along to it or not, is maybe where it suffered a bit, I guess. But yeah, I think it feels like we'll keep apologizing for the tour side of this album, which isn't our requirement because it's U2's issue, not ours. But
what's also interesting about Magnificent is you have Bono, Terry Lawless, and Will.i.am on keyboards on that particular track.
That's where it feels like it's a bit eclectic in the composition of the music and in who they sort of allowed to get into it. I know Tim had mentioned the chat room, it's the first time Terry Lawless is on the actual record. And so, you know, just in terms of obviously kind of pulling at a few straws to like make this album come together almost, like, and, you know, alluding to the fact, like Sherry said, that they're, you know, writing other stuff as well at the same time and taking quite a long time from the previous album to get it out and all that kind of stuff contributed to, yeah, a bit of a mixed bag as far as the album, it seems.
And I think this is the first time, really, that they have had a lot of collaborators on the albums. In fact, co-writes with Eno and Lanois as well.
Yeah.
Terry Lawless certainly, if not the first time he's playing the U2 album, I think he may have done, but certainly the first time he's been credited playing on a U2 album. And, there's a lot of different inputs into this album. But, I mean, they've been doing that for quite a while now, and I think that's probably because they just struggle so much from the freeform style of how they record. I mean, this is why the Rick Rubin-produced songs never came out, and I don't think in reality that they'll ever make an album of Rick Rubin, because he just wants to record 12 songs in 2 days and release it the following week. Then they couldn't do that. We know they can't do that. They can't record one track in 12 weeks.
If they have 2 weeks left on their record contract, and they don't want to be served a cease and desist on breaking their contract, I think that then and only then we will get a produced album if they're under that type of a deadline.
Exactly.
All right, let's keep moving to A Moment of Surrender.
Well, this is a song that when it was live, I called it the moment of show ender, because it was the last song in the set. And if you didn't want to sit in 6 hours worth of traffic, you were already hightailing it to the car. If you happen to have the vinyl of No Line on the Horizon, it's the first song on side B. It was a double vinyl set. You'd flip over the first vinyl and then you'd be met with this one. For me, this song had an immediate connection. I was going through some personal stuff about my dad, about my grandfather at the time, and just the vision of, you know, I did not notice the passersby and they did not notice me, about that ultimate decision that you have to make at some point in your life. And most recently, it was a year ago this April, you know, I found myself in a position where I had about 30 minutes left on this planet, had the doctor not done what he did. And as I'm being wheeled into the operating room, I couldn't notice anybody passing by and they weren't noticing me. And this was the song that was playing on a loop in the back of my head, because I was in this position where I have to surrender. You know, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. I do not have any control left in my life other than to pray. And luckily that prayer was answered, because I'm still above the daisies. But this song got real, real. And when the recording process was happening with it, I was reading in some articles that those who were in the room at the time, there was a hush that came upon everybody at the conclusion of the recording of this song, because it felt like God had moved through the room while this was being recorded. If you think about sacred U2 songs, for me, this one ranks right up there as number one.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those songs that can, I feel like it's sonically sounds like of this time, like of the No Line time period, but could fit very well lyrically on any album of U2's, and is definitely a highlight for me.
For me too, yeah.
Yeah.
I really liked it as a way to end the show as well. Although it was a bit sad always. Kind of fit into the idea of, oh, the show is over now.
the show is over. Go in peace and be among your people. You know.
Yeah.
The one thing about this particular song is as a closer for the concerts was just fantastic, because it's a long song, isn't it? I mean, and it was probably longer live than it was on the album. The album's about 7-8 minutes long, but I thought it was lovely the way it was played in the live setting. And particularly at night, you know, with the last song coming 11 o'clock at night, there's a lovely vibe. You had a few drinks and the whole Eno meandering, because there's very much of a groove going through the whole of this song, isn't it? Very much the Moroccan Fez style recordings that they did. And I just thought that it was a very cerebral song, very touching, lovely lyrics.
Singing the whoa-oh-oh as they're leaving the concert, you know?
I also liked how Larry was also singing during the concert.
That's right.
Yeah.
Actually getting the mic on, like turning the mic on and putting it in front of him,
as opposed to Adam, whose mic is never turned on.
And it is that... like it has some of the hallmarks of a U2 classic U2 song, like even the audience response opportunity or whatever, which you know that, you know, they consciously are aware of that when they record a song like that, that they could potentially do that. But having the drum loop, like the intro and just hearing that sort of sounding, I'm thinking back to when I saw the tour in Edmonton and that knowing, like you said, Shane, knowing that the show is likely over, but just the way that they can, Bono especially, you could see kind of enjoying sitting on that moment for a while of the sort of looping intro starting and being able to sort of riff on that if he wants, or just go right into the song, and gives him a bit of sort of freedom and flexibility that way. So, all right. So we like that one. Let's keep going. Unknown Colors next. This one, it's funny actually listening to, I'm trying to think of the last time I listened to some of these songs with headphones, and just the stuff you hear different in headphones than you would in like a computer speaker or, you know, room speakers or whatever that are maybe cheaper than the headphones I'm listening to, and just hearing some of the acoustic guitar in there and stuff like that. This is one I remember always with the lyric of, you know, including lyrics that are kind of like almost a call out to some, shout out for some nerds who are listening, the Reboot Yourself and
the 333 was Jeremiah 33:3, call unto me and I will answer thee,
call back to all that you can't leave behind, but the restart, reboot yourself, you're free to go, password if you enter it here, that kind of stuff, and a bit of like
Force quit and move to trash.
Yeah, that's the one.
They totally alienated anybody who doesn't own an Apple product on that. Yeah. I had to wonder,
like,
what
me.
Are they talking about? Because
yeah.
I'm an Android, you know?
Yeah,
I didn't know either.
So they had precursor, I guess, or whatever, to future Apple events, I guess.
Which, ironically, this tour was sponsored by BlackBerry.
Yeah, I know. That was the funniest part.
I digress.
I kind of thought it was going to be more of an Apple tie-in that they would do just because of that. But these are the ones that are like, it's an Adam, a good Adam song as far as bass line stuff. You get to really hear the bass. It's up in the mix. And sort of the stream of consciousness stuff that lyrically Bono throws in there that I think is just always makes for a fun song, whether it's an amazing song or not, I don't know, but it definitely paints a great picture of a place sort of in between reality and technology and living in on the internet and living in the real world and kind of somewhere stuck in between as you go along. So
There's that internal dialogue. This is very much, you know, a song that's like a duet almost, where you've got the chanting, which to me represents that that internal spirit or that soul trying to talk to you to say, hey, wake up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Anybody else, unknown caller, before we move on? You don't have to comment if you don't want to, but if there's nothing to say.
Not answering.
I just to comment again to this, I think it's one of the very early songs recorded back in the days of Fez, and you know, you've got the birds coming through at the beginning, all tweeting in the background. Again, another lovely little gentle song, and another great song live. I don't think we'll ever hear it again. I don't think it'll be played live again, but you say it's a nice, very pleasant song by U2. It's a good one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's anyways, we'll leave it at that. I'll go crazy if I don't go crazy tonight is the next track. Generation gets a chance to change the world.
Yeah, I really love this song. It's always makes me really happy and makes me smile. And for me, this was really a very uplifting song when I was going through some rough times in, like, in summer 2009. And I particularly love the, like, the video for it. They have this the animated video they made for, which, yeah, it just always lifts me up and warms my heart to see how it all ends up well. So yeah, well, one of my favorite songs.
I don't think I remember seeing that animated video. I won't watch it right now. Obviously, that would be.
Yeah, there's the concert film
version
from Barcelona. Barcelona and Somerville were the only two locations, I believe, where they performed this one album-wise, and then it morphed into the rave disco version, which now the, when I hear the song on the album, I'm like, wow, this is sort of folksy, you know, or dare I say poppy, because I'm so used to that that rave, you know.
I didn't really like the live version that much.
I was fortunate to hear the standard version, which has hardly been played live. Was it the next night at Barcelona? They played it in the full discotechy style-y live way, and I couldn't believe what was going on. I thought, what the hell are they doing? But actually, over time, like I said, I've actually preferred the nightclub disco version, you know, the live version. It's not a song I go crazy on. Oh, no, I can't believe I said that. It's not, I don't go crazy for it, but it's a good song, but it's very poppy, isn't it? It's a very pop song.
Well, I think the disco version, it worked live, but I wouldn't listen to it like normally. I wouldn't like it.
The lyrics are a bit poor. I'm not sure it's great lyrically. Isn't there a few babies all going all the way through?
Oh, yeah. But
yeah. I think when Bono's stuck, he writes down a few babies.
I think you're either you love Bono singing Baby or you hate it. I think that there's no in between on those ones. But I do like whether you everybody needs to cry or needs to spit, every sweet tooth needs just a little hit, every beauty needs to go out with an idiot. It kind of like on their own, they're kind of weird. I don't know, less, but as a whole stanza, I think it works. And I do like it. I can hear what you're saying.
Yeah, it's not great lyrically, but still it's, I don't know. I still like it. I don't know. Yeah.
And it is a fun, interesting one musically too, I think, for the way just the edge just in the background there of some of the music that he's doing and guitar wise or whatever, it kind of just sets an interesting tone. And it's, again, sounds a little different than your typical U2 song, but as a whole structure, it feels very U2-y, but you know, it's not the positive, overly positive spin of like Sweetest Thing or something, but it has that light feel to it anyways. So, all right. The moment we've been waiting for, the lead single. I'll just play it and we'll see if anybody has any thoughts. We can probably
just switch off now.
Well, nobody else wanted to take this one, so I will. But there's a few. We had a few comments from people when we asked. So you can submit comments, questions to ask #AskAtU2 on Twitter, and we'll include that in future shows. And U2GW in the chat room says, at least you played the best part of the song.
Yeah.
So we'll go quickly here. At Obud1 said, "Get on Your Boots is Get on Your Boots the worst U2 single, and is Mona Surrender one of the best songs? Your thoughts," which we kind of touched on. At Tim Jahar said, "Why was Boots decided on our first single? What else was considered?" At U2 War 40 says, "Get on Your Boots the first single. Hogwash should have been Breathe." At Shazad Tech said, "Why on earth was the lead single Get on Your Boots?" And then I quickly tweeted before we started the show saying, if there's any Get on the Boots fans out there, they need to get on their boots and get us some comments, because it's overwhelming the other way. And at the Doors, DF71 said, "The best thing I can say about Boots is that it's okay." And
live.
Live. Sorry. Yeah, that was on the next line. I missed that. And at KWalsh12 said, Get In Your Boots is great. Catchy, poppy, Beatles-esque, prefer it to Vertigo. So there you go. That's a lot of commentary on it. I think, like, it's one of those songs, definitely I agree, not a great single choice in hindsight for sure. And it's one of those songs like that should have been a great hidden gem B-side, like I'm thinking of like Big Girls Are Best or something like that, where it's like, wow, that doesn't sound like U2, but it totally does, and it could work if they threw it into a concert. But leading it as a single, as has been discussed already, we don't think was the best choice. I think we can all agree. Anybody have any other commentary on Get On Your Boots?
For me, the music was schizophrenic. They couldn't decide on a particular vibe to go with, so they just put it into one big jumbo. That's what it felt like. You know, you get into a rhythm and then you get whooshed into something completely opposite sonically. I'm wondering if in the end, and maybe this is the glasses half full way of looking at it, their desire was to have it be completely messed up like that in order for you to listen to what the lyrics are, which in today's world seem very appropriate nowadays.
Yeah, it seems like almost one of those things where Edge, I'm just projecting here, I have no idea if this is true or not, but Edge had this riff that he really wanted to use. It was a riff that he thought was the best riff ever, and Bono had some lyrics that he thought were really good, and they shouldn't have been used together. They should have been two separate songs, and there's some other version of Get On Your Boots that mixes better in the archives of U2's recording history, but we'll never hear it. Yeah. So
I think one of the major problems with the song, it's image about the song, isn't it, as well? Because, you know, going back to the calling card, you know, we've had Beautiful Day as the lead single of All That You Can't Leave Behind. We then have Vertigo. So, I mean, you know, crikey, trying to finish, you know, have a triple run here and have the next lead single. I think they tried far too hard to try to replicate the sound and the style of this calling card song. They do it reasonably well with Joey Ramone on the last album, but this one is just too fast. The song is far too fast. Live.
And the video was also...
Well, they look ridiculous, actually, as well. And the lyrics don't suit Bono. How old is he when the song comes out? He's 49 and singing Sexy Boots? I don't know. It seemed rather strange. I didn't understand it at all. It doesn't fit in thematically or lyrically with the rest of the album. And I think we're being a bit polite about the song, because it really won't go down in the history of U2 as a proud moment. And I think even Edge has realized that it's just a bad song, full stop.
Yeah, I don't think we'll see it on the best of 2000 to 2020.
Which would be a interesting omission, just because, you know, just saying like, okay, the single wasn't something that... It would kind of be them admitting that we all shouldn't just move on.
Which is probably why we don't have another best of album in the works at the moment.
All right, let's go into stand-up comedy.
This is the perfect marriage, or this would be the byproduct if the Beatles' Revolution and Bob Marley's Get Up Stand Up had a kid. and what boggled my mind with this particular song was at the shows, you're selling T-shirts that says "Stand Up to Rock Stars." This is one of those get everybody singing and pounding fists in the air about, you know, you got to stand up and all this other stuff. And they completely did not perform the song. This one was left off the set list. Yeah, it was never played live. Right. And it's got that sonic guitar room sound that could just fill up the whole stadium, get everybody into it. And it was a lost cause.
I was amazed that this song was never played live in the tour, because it's so suited to a 360 big outdoor, big big, big song, as you say, big riff on it. It's very much like a Led Zeppelin song as well.
Yeah.
In the vibe. You know, I think Edge, is it around that time that Edge did the film with Jimmy
Page? It Might Get Loud.
Yeah, and I don't know whether that was an influence on the song in terms of Edge and the guitarist, but it's very much as close to Jimmy Page style of riff that he's done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That came out in 2009, so it's very possible that they would have filmed, while they're recording No Line somewhere.
Yeah, it was around that time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Lyrically, I have no clue what this song's about. Not in the slightest.
No.
No idea whatsoever.
But I do like some of the images that conjured up. Like Napoleon is in high heels, and especially the one about stop helping God across the road like a little old lady. I mean, yeah, that's just awesome.
Yeah.
I think you understand what I say. I have no idea what that song's about.
No. I took it as Napoleon in high heels would be Bono with his Cuban heel, and Josephine, be careful of small men with big ideas. Bono's full of big ideas. Yeah. Is he comparing himself to Napoleon? You be the judge. I'm not going to go there because I still want to be on his kind list. I see this song as a struggle with faith in either you're either going to let God do what God needs to do in your life, or you're going to say, no, I got this. Let me help you across that street type of thing. And it's that bounce back and forth between deeds and grace, between, is it what I do or do I just have faith that'll get done? And you know, the whole stand-up comedy, you know, you're trying to take humor in a pretty tough situation and figure it out. I think sonically this should have been performed. Lyrically, I can't see Bono standing in front of the stadium and telling people, you know, about a kid crossing an 8-lane highway on a voyage of discovery.
But I like that line, though, is I got to stand up to my ego, but my ego is not really the enemy. It's like a small child crossing an 8-lane highway on a voyage. Like I think he loves to be a bit self-deprecating. And I think
he's having a laugh at himself.
Yeah. And I think that's where you could totally see, like you said, you know, Edge rocking around the stage, playing the riff out to the crowd and
Bono taking the piss out of him.
Yeah. And you could totally see it. Absolutely. And I'm shocked. I'm shocked that they never played it live. Like we've said, it just seems like it must have, you know, when they rehearsed it and prepped it or whatever, I'm assuming they tried it, that they just couldn't get it to work with the same kind of energy as they had in the studio. But yeah, it seems.
But they managed to play Get On Your Bass. Good. What went wrong?
All right, let's keep moving before we go backwards in the track listing. So this is definitely, like I said earlier, if this is an album of Bono wailing, this is probably the prime candidate for the wails. And I don't know how exactly it's like the sort of character and place he's putting you, and you're sonically you're there. It just as a track, a full track on the album, and that's where I struggle with how it fits exactly and why it got included, whereas in the past, you know, stuff like this didn't get included as much on the albums. But
maybe it was their way to confirm, yes, we were in Fez, Morocco.
Right.
We even named a song after it.
Yeah, in the Pantheon, we've discussed having an episode talking about songs named after locations, and this would, for me anyways, would be lower on the list as far as favorites, definitely as far as a song, but sonically, I guess it sort of helps ground you in where they were and what's going on around you and things like that. But
I, you know, if you try and pick another song in the catalog of U2 where it's got a similar reason for being recorded, it's probably something like Elvis Presley in America off the Unforgettable Fire. So this is a very much an Eno and Lanois, where the studio board is an instrument.
Right.
So I think this song hasn't even been written by U2. It's really just a bunch of different songs, different tracks. And when I say tracks, I mean musical, instrumental tracks being spliced together.
Yeah.
It's very much, it's the most experimental song on the album by a long, long way. And but it's there, I think, because the songs that follow it, it changes the mood. So we go away from the middle section of Get On Your Boots and
comedy, yeah.
I'll Go Crazy, you know, they're all a bit, you know, it's a three-part album, isn't it, really? There's, you know, there's, it's a key shift in the mood of the album for the following songs from this, from Fez Being Born onwards.
Yes.
There's some pretty good information about the album. Well, of course it would be about the album, but about this song in particular in the hardcover book that came with the box set for No Line on the Horizon.
Yes.
And I'm currently putting up onto Twitter the 3 or 4 paragraphs all about this particular song, which I'm sure Chris will put into the show notes.
If I can figure out how to do that, I will. At YouTube War 40 says, Fez Born Being Born creatively combines the sonic space of Joshua Tree, disjointed sounds of Zuropa, and dare I say, Swagger of Passengers, which is an interesting call out, but I can definitely see that. And I was going to say, you know, a lot of the, like what Aaron said with the sort of mixing board, it almost, I don't know if this sounds like a knock, I guess, but it feels a bit like, you know, like we said, Bono and Edge are off somewhere. Eno and Lanois are kind of given a little bit more freedom to direct the album than maybe they would have otherwise. And so there's, not in like a bullying sense, they get to dictate what's on the tracks, but there is kind of their stamp is more obvious, I guess. They're in less of U2 being sort of in charge on every single track. There's kind of a shared space, more like Passengers, like U2 War 40 is saying. So.
That's right. Yeah, I go back to what I said right at the beginning. Is this is probably the only album you two have done where it just blends a lot of different styles of their previous albums into one album, without it being the main theme. But certainly, Eno and Lanois have a large influence on this album, just from the co-writes alone.
Yeah. All right. Let's keep moving to White as Snow.
In this way.
I just cut it off, I guess, before the Edge's solo there. But sorry, Edge, if you're listening, it's a nice solo.
You better be listening.
That's what I was in. We try to keep like 20 to 30 second clips, just because of you know, staying on the good side of the legal department. But often it's a struggle of choosing a good song moment, lyrically moment, versus a Edge solo moment, and. Unfortunately, like most things, Bono usually wins. So, this song, anyways, is for the I guess the more religious folks out there, definitely is kind of like a fairly obvious one to turn to. But I find there is that, but also the story that it tells and the lyric of as boys we would go hunting in the woods, asleep the night, shooting out the stars. The way the song ends and has a bigger sort of crescendo at the end that. Maybe isn't you don't think is going to be coming is always sort of redeems the song for me, to use a bad word in terms of the religious angle, but I think it's a beautiful song and goes again feels like it sets you in a space that is like Aaron had said at the beginning of the podcast, of kind of putting you in a nice space, and it's not hyper aggressive and is a kind of a way to sort of come down from the middle third of the album. So.
Yeah, I thought because it really tells a story about, we would go hunting in the woods, and it was like more of a complete story, not as impressionistic as many U2 songs are. So that's what I like about this song.
And it feels quite a winter type of song, because I think just before you... you played the excerpt there. Wasn't it just about to go into the French? Is it a French horn? Sounds like a
French horn. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking solo, but it's actually a French horn.
Yeah, again, it's another mood song, isn't it, really? It's very cerebral type of song.
Breathe is the next song we're going to jump to.
Breathe.
See, there you go. I put in, I knew there was one I had Edge's solo as the key frame or sample. So anyways, Aaron, go ahead.
Oh, I love this song. I just love it. It's fantastic on the record. It was fantastic live. Lyseth, you mentioned earlier about this opening some of the shows. I remember this in Dublin in particular. It was just awesome, absolutely awesome. Really? And this song absolutely took off and literally just went to the moon on this song live. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. And I'm a big fan of James Joyce, and I just love the references in the first line of the song, 16th of June, which for those who like James Joyce have read Ulysses is a great nod to that book. So yeah, this is just brilliant, and a big long song as well. It really rocks. I love it.
I just really liked the song as well when it was opening live, like I said before. Just really love. Well, I'm a big Larry fan, so, you know, him taking the stage first and then, like, pounding the drums is just really, I love that. So, yeah, it's a little bit like the opposite of him leaving the stage last during 40, so, yeah.
Yeah, I love the rapid-fire lyric, and I'm not as up on my James Joyce, so I wasn't aware of that, but that's awesome connection to know about and have to go do a bit more reading and find those. But like just the lyrically of rapid-fire that Bono had to do, and he was even able to, you know, maintain that live. I guess I remember hearing it on the record and thinking that, wondering whether they would actually do it live just because of the amount of words that he'd have to spit out. And I remember them doing, I think they did it on like the Letterman show here in the North America, in the US. And then the remix or slightly different version that was on either single and or the Nelson Mandela version.
Right? Yeah, there's alternative lyrics, wasn't there, for Nelson Mandela?
Yeah.
Bono had two versions of the song. Same melody and everything,
but
two different lyrics.
Yeah. Yeah, just a great track all around.
And again, you know, some of the lyrics. Sorry, I haven't got the lyric sheet in front of me, but where he comes from, traveling salesman
on my other side.
Yeah. Some great lyrics on that song.
Yeah, even the like sort of putting the question to the listener of, you know, so why would I invite a complete stranger in my home? Would you? And the just some of the imagery of. That he conjures up with the lyric, and Doc says you're fine or dying, pleased, and yeah, the people we meet will not be drowned out. There's nothing you have that I need. I can breathe, and sort of the freedom and celebration of life in a sense that it shows. And I found grace. It's all that I found, and I can breathe. Now I just want to go listen. Like we often say on these episodes, I want to go listen to the whole song. And
do you think this could have made a single? I think it could have done.
I wonder that too, because it feels a little bit like it's your, even like we said about Get on the Boots, where you're hard, Get on Your Boots, and you're, it's sort of hard to like lock in exactly which kind of song it's trying to be. Like I think the song survives and is great in spite of that or because of that, depending on how you look at that. But it does kind of have these two different sort of feels to it that aren't always, don't necessarily gel in my mind anyways, exactly great, but it certainly works. But yeah, I don't know. It feels like it could have been a good single just because you can see a video, a good director anyways, having a lot of fun with a video, even though videos obviously aren't as important these days, but just as far as setting a tone for the album and the tour and stuff with it, could have had a lot of fun with it.
I'm not a musician, but I think also as well, it has an unusual beat. I don't know what, it's not a standard 4/4 song, as they say. I think it's quite hard for the band to play it live. And I thought they did a really brilliant job.
Yeah.
Because it has a different tempo. Is it time signature?
Yeah, it'd be probably
it's all quite
3/4 swing, almost not swing exactly, but like a swing. And so that's where you get a lot of that sort of tension in the music too, of Edge, the way he has to sort of hold the note longer than he would have and that kind of stuff. So, which U2 doesn't often do for whatever reason. They typically stick to the beat.
It's a song that I think they really have to concentrate on playing live, because it's so easy to make a mistake on, to just get get the tempo wrong and the time wrong, and it'll sound awful.
Yeah, and U2GW in Sharon says, I think it's 6/8, which could also be just off off the top.
I don't even know what a 6/8 is, but it sounds complicated.
Six beats in the measure instead of three or four. 4/4 would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, yeah. 3, 4. Anyways, that's our musical lesson for the episode. But it isn't often that U2 goes outside of 4/4 into something either 3/4 or 6/8 where it gives it more of a swing to it. But it definitely, like we said, it works. Gives it some room to breathe, you might say.
Oh, very good.
There we go. Okay, let's keep moving before the puns get really bad.
The worst of us are a long, drawn-out confession. The best of us are geniuses of compression. You say you're not going to leave the truth alone.
Yeah, U2 War 40, I just had mentioned, I love Bono writing in the third person on Cedars of Lebanon. Hendrix guitar by Edge is subtle and awesome. And at Bruner Caffe, he said, I didn't really like the album back then, but I must say it's gotten better over time. Cedars of Lebanon is the highlight for me. So, Aaron, you had some thoughts on?
Yeah, I think I totally agree. I think this is a beautiful song. It wasn't played live, but the imagery of the song is just fantastic. And if you've seen the Anton Cabin linear video album, effectively that accompanies the various releases for this album, this is the last track, obviously, on that video. And I just love the way that the Cedars Lebanon, you know, the East Mediterranean part, and we see different images from the perspective of an immigrant in particular on that video coming through on the song. And I love the lyrics. I love the last lines in particular. I think it's
choose your enemies carefully because they will define you. Yeah. Make them interesting because in some ways they will mind you. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great lyric there. They're not there at the beginning, but when your story ends, going to last with you longer than your friends. That's the one, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Super. Yeah, like we said, if this is a character album, this to me is one of the best sort of characters that he gets into on the album. And it doesn't have any sort of big, huge redemption of, you know, the solo and solo and then the bridge and then a big chorus at the end or something to sort of bring you back. On a positive note, per se, it kind of just leaves you.
It's a song that is, it's obviously quite a downbeat song, and it's quite an emotional song as well. I think, you know, it depends how you listen to your albums, whether you like to listen to the album from start to finish. It's not a song that you can just play. It's certainly, you know, it's a bit like Mothers of the Disappeared, isn't it, this song?
Yeah.
It has a certain reason for being on the album. And it's got that, you know, this album has got a lovely arc to it as well. And this finishes off the album in a lovely way.
And it's also one of note, it's one of the few U2 songs that actually has a swear in it that is left in the record full stop, I guess. It's they don't always... Yep. And Bono doesn't cover it up or anything like that. So you can tell it's just a song that I don't know how they feel about it. Obviously, it didn't, like you said, it didn't resonate enough or didn't make sense enough to have it in the set list anywhere live. But it's definitely a beautiful song and something that's put set to the visuals in linear, which we can jump into as a sort of transition point, I guess. It definitely works as a backing track for that in an amazing way. And sort of, you know, of any song on the album, almost seems like that is destined and written kind of almost for that idea of let's make a video or music version of this album and using Cedars of Lebanon as a sort of jumping off point for that. So for anyone who's not aware, I guess it came with the deluxe edition, I think, and I'm assuming the box set as well. I know I bought it off of iTunes, I think, and got the download of it. So it wasn't anything that was that hard to find. I know for me, it often messed up my playlist because I would throw the No Line on the Horizon album in somewhere, and all of a sudden there's this video playing, hour-long video that's playing in the background. I'm curious, what are your guys' thoughts on? It's not every album, obviously, that U2 has a full hour-long video version of the album that they ship. What are your thoughts on sort of, I guess, whether that works and makes sense, and then, you know, how, specifically this one, how it worked and didn't or didn't.
It's a little strange when you play it at first, because, of course, the first track, if I remember right, is Winter, which doesn't make the album.
No, it's not Winter.
Is it not Winter? What is it?
Unknown Caller, I think.
Okay, yeah.
Right, because he put it together, and then the track listing changed on the album, I think.
That's right, yeah, that's right. I can't remember where it is, but Winter is either one of the first couple of songs on the track listing.
It's the third song, yeah.
It's the third song, yeah. And, of course, you know, you play it and you think, well, where's that on the album? And it's a bit hard to understand. I don't think I Go Crazy's on this, if I remember right. It's a long time since I played it, unfortunately. But, I loved Linear. I actually really enjoyed it. And I remember going back to Cedars Lebanon, I remember watching effectively a film. It's not a music video, is it? It's a proper full-length one-hour film. So there's a story behind it, and I watched it from start to finish. And you say you watched the is it a policeman, isn't it, who's effectively going through France and then ends up obviously
Cadiz,
Lebanon. Yeah, he's trying to get to Tripoli, I think, isn't he? I think that's the whole point. And you know, you see him go away on the little boat across the sea. So it's quite a poignant film, actually, in its own right. And this is when, I mean, effectively, Antoine Cabine is actually starting to become a film director in his own right. I think he's done the Joy Division film at this point as well. So it's in black and white, just like that film is. I think it's great. And I think this is probably, Sherry, you'll have a view on this, I'm sure. Where
sure.
Bono is trying to make the whole reason for an album. You know, we're seeing this thing with Songs of Experience, where there's meant to be some collaboration, perhaps with Apple, so that we listen to an album in the proper sense, you know, from start to finish, and there'll be some type of interaction. I think this is U2's attempt back in 2009 to do so.
Well, it was interesting because I don't know if you guys seen the liner notes about it.
For Felinia.
Yes. Where it says that this project started in late May of 2008.
Mm. Yeah.
Yep.
So that's how they're. Yeah, much later.
Yeah.
So
actually, you know, I was actually at Hanover in the Easter, I think it was the April of 2008, and met Lanois and Edge outside, and they were saying that the album was a long way from being finished. I don't even think they had lyrics for some of the songs, was what I was told.
Some could argue that it still isn't finished.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I mean, if Anton was, I never thought of that before. Yeah, if Anton was given this task to do an hour long film of songs that didn't make the album, I mean, he's done a great job in some respects.
Yeah, the liner notes ended saying, "Thus, Linear is a very interesting hybrid version of No Line on the Horizon, partly how it was in May 2008 and partly how it is now. Tomorrow is always partly yesterday, apparently."
Mm.
Mm-hmm. It was a very nice way of an artist saying, they kind of left me hanging and I had to do something with the best I could.
Screw you guys, you get what you get, and you don't get upset.
Lisette, you kind of implied that you really liked it too. Is there something in particular about it that is sort of draws you into it?
Well, I really liked Winter, because it's like it's that part where the copy goes, where you really, you see what he sees while he's driving down the road, and then you have this whole mountain pass. While Winter is playing, so I like these images there, and also, well, the lyrics for Winter are really beautiful. I think the way Bono's voice cracks up a bit sometimes, I really like that song.
So Winter would have been a better choice than Get on Your Boots for the album. Is that what we're all saying?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, for sure.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
So has Winter been released in any official form other than on this, or is it still sort of locked?
The Brothers soundtrack, right?
Oh, right, yeah. Sorry, that was what you said. Yeah, right. So there is a way for folks to hear it outside of the...
And there's a few other little tracks that have come out, haven't there, you know, from the recordings. I mean, we got the Soon song. Remember Soon? It was used in the 360. Didn't that come out on a 7-inch single? Didn't it come out with the live deluxe box set of 360?
Correct. And that's the only way you could get that as a single.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So Soon was used, you know, as one of the walk-on songs.
For the 2011 360 tour.
Yeah,
I don't think it was the walk-on song for 2009.
Yeah, used on the latter stages. And, you know, the whole 360, we going back to where we were talking about earlier, they did start experimenting with some of the live shows, certainly in 2010 in Europe. We started hearing Every Breaking Wave. We started hearing North Star, Glastonbury, a few different versions.
Mercy.
We had Return of the Stingray guitar opening each of the shows. So a very experimental set list in some respects. And also, of course, you know, some of the never-to-be-heard-again songs were played for the first time. I didn't ever expect to hear The Unforgettable Fire as a track to be played, and that was played. So, you know, lots of memories of this particular tour, but less so of No Line of the on the Horizon as it progressed.
Yeah.
In the very early stages, you know, we had seven or even eight tracks probably off the album in the very early days of the show, of the tour. But they did that with Songs of Innocence, didn't they? They played quite a lot of songs on the North American tour, which then just started to drop off as time goes on. They experiment.
Yeah, and actually, U2GW in the chat room asked if this is the beginning of U2's paralysis by analysis phase, where they hold and tweak endlessly. And I think there's an argument to be made that they definitely have sort of the luxury now of more time, and they can give themselves more time. They don't have the pressure to. I mean, there's contract stuff, but they don't have the pressure necessarily to get an album out now, and because they have to strike on, you know, the same way they did when they were a younger band. And plus Bono, of course, and other members have more interests elsewhere outside of the band that keep them occupied otherwise. So you could certainly
make... You also have the risk there, though, of you know, we've already had two incidents with the lead singer where he could have been out for the count. You never know when this is going to be the band's last album. So I think that they're being very protective in what they release. And I do agree that it started in 2009. They're being very protective in what they give out, because you don't know if that's going to be the last original chapter while all four band members are still, you know, above ground. And they want to be absolutely 100% positively sure that this is the music that they want to release.
Right, they could, but if they did it faster, they could release more albums before somebody kicks them. You can go
then
both.
Let's bring back in Rick Rubin then.
Yeah, exactly.
The quality control is really high, isn't it, for U2? I mean, you know, the worst album. I don't even know if we have that. And trying to be objective, because we're all big U2 fans, but worst album. It just doesn't make sense. You can apply that with lots of other acts, but U2, it's not so easy.
Which is the fun of being on a YouTube podcast, and also for folks out there being able to respond to said podcast. If you want to tweet at us, let's go around the room, virtual room as it were. For those, if you're not aware, we don't actually record all in the same space. Aaron, where are you in the world, and what's your Twitter handle if you would like to share that so people can disagree?
Well, I'm based in central England in the county of Warwickshire. And my Twitter handle is @Ivanobe, IVANOBE.
All right. And Lisette, where are you in the world, and how are you? How can we get in the sound by tweeting at you?
I'm in the Netherlands, and my handle is Aquabat Girl.
And Sherry, how about you? What's
I am in the land where Super Bowl champions are made, the Boston area.
Jeez.
Go Pats! And
I'll edit that out.
Find me.
No. <Just kidding. laughs>
You can find me at U2ComSherry as always.
And I'm in the Great White North, where we're suffering through snow and winter and ice, much like
six
winter.
6 more weeks of winter, right, Chris?
Yeah, apparently that's what the groundhog said. And I'm iChris on Twitter, and you can follow at U2, twitter.com/ATU2. Of course, at U2.com is the website. There'll be lots more links to things we discussed. Didn't get to in the episode, links to articles on YouTube at U2.com about from various folks' take on songs and moments from No Line on the Horizon. And you can find all those things at goodstuff.fm/ATU2/49, because this is episode number 49. Go 49ers. And we will see you again next time for episode number 50. If all goes according to plan, there should be... I don't know what we'll call it. If it's longer than a B-side, but it's not a full episode where...
EP?
Yeah, maybe an EP. Matt and myself have a special chat with Andy Green from Rolling Stone after his interviews he published with Adam and Edge and Willie Williams. That's coming up. And then, of course, barring a last-minute album release, there'll be an episode on Songs of Ascent, and then we'll be finished our album... by album series. And
I mean, we're not doing the 30th anniversary of the Joshua Tree when it gets re-released in March.
I'm sure we'll have a few Joshua Tree discussions to have to happen over the next little while, including, of course, when the tour opener happens and a whole bunch of the At U2 folks, including Aaron, I think, right? You're coming across the pond, I heard.
I hope so
if the family lets you leave.
yeah. I'm coming over.
So if you're going to be in the Vancouver area for that opener, we'd love to hear from you at some point. We'll have more on that later, but for now I think we'll sign off and see you next time. Thanks for listening. Bye.